The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Ewan Potts. On today's programme, we're going to dig into the government's Rwanda policy and Rishi Sunak's pledge to stop the boats.
Yeah, last night, of course, the House of Lords has delayed the legislation further. It would see illegal migrants deported to the African country. It's another blow for the Prime Minister as he tries to get these planes off the ground. Remember, the PM's promised to do the first deportation flight only months away in June. And this issue has been rumbling on for 2 years. This is when Boris Johnson did the initial deal with Rwanda. The legislation was introduced in March 2023. It was rejected by the Supreme Court also last year that ruled it unlawful. So this has been an ongoing issue.
The Rwanda issue involves a lot of political threads. I think first and foremost, Tory divisions and Rishi Sunak's authority within his own party. High-profile Conservatives, including former Home Secretary Suella Braverman, have made no secret of their discontent at the implementation of this policy. And the resistance of the House of Lords is controversial too. Should peers be able to continue to reject or delay bills that have passed the Commons? Some commentators say the Lords have gone against the will of the people. Others insist that scrutiny of legislation is the whole point of the second chamber.
Yeah, and all of those threats have led to a knotty ball for the Prime Minister, something that we're going to dig into on this programme. Because, of course, beyond the UK, beyond the general election here, this is a year hugely important globally simply for the number of elections that are going to take place. I mean, some freer and fairer than others, to be totally blunt. And this issue is no less incendiary in many other countries, the US, South Africa, India, Ireland, many places, a lot of politicians talking about migration. And yet the global data tells us quite a different story.
Yeah, populist leaders have been pushing the idea that migration is out of control. But according to the latest UN data, as a percentage of humanity, population, international migrants make up 3.6% of the global population. Now, that figure is rising, but perhaps more slowly than you might expect. I was certainly surprised. Back in 1990, it was just under 3%. So a modest rise, really, over the course of the last, 35 years or so. But let's bring in Bloomberg's senior economy and government editor, Alan Crawford, who's been writing about immigration and the data. Now, the cold hard numbers don't scream crisis, but when you look at many countries, there is a great deal of antipathy, hostility in many cases, towards international migrants, isn't there?
Absolutely, and it's cropping up in all sorts of surprising places. For example, in New Zealand, a traditionally open society, we're seeing numbers of legal migration at record levels, and so the government is saying that this is unsustainable. Equally in Ireland, you're seeing the government is unable to deal with the numbers that, unable to house the numbers of people arriving, and that's feeding into the political debate, which is getting somewhat nasty.
Yeah, and a lot of countries also making the distinction between legal migrants and illegal migrants, as they would see it. I mean, the numbers are also very unevenly distributed. What do the numbers tell us, the latest data out of the UN?
As you mentioned, then, as a percentage of the total global population, the UN is very keen to stress that it's very small, and that international migration between countries is very much the exception. That most people, if they migrate, if they're forced to move or want to move, it's within borders. So that in terms of the overall numbers, there are obviously pressure points, you know, such as the Darien Gap in Central America, where people are making their way north to the United States, and indeed the Mediterranean, where one of the most shocking numbers is that something like 1,865 people have died or are missing so far this year trying to cross the Mediterranean.
Alan, just tell us about some more of the countries that you've studied and how governments are responding to public unease at immigration.
South Africa, for example, the famed Rainbow Nation, that where the ANC came to power 30 years ago after helping to defeat apartheid, there the government is starting to turn against migrants, mainly from neighbouring countries like Zimbabwe, because it sees it as potentially, a popular issue to latch onto, and it's behind in the poll, or at least it's not faring as well as it has historically in the polls running up to elections next month. So it's trying to use migration to leverage more popular support.
Mm. And you also mentioned Ireland, again, a kind of a surprising inclusion. Only this week, another step further forwards in the long-running issue of tougher legislation on migration. It passed in the European Parliament just earlier this week. But Ireland, quite surprising in the inclusion in this study.
Yes, Ireland traditionally has not really seen much at all in the way of right-wing populist political parties or movement sentiment. But with the numbers of arrivals now, it's putting a squeeze on housing in Ireland. And it basically, people are unhappy at how the government is treating the whole issue. And of course, there's a supreme irony because Ireland is a country that's been marked indelibly by emigration.
Alan, perhaps inevitably, this debate is often framed as people wanting to come to the West from poorer countries. But actually, a huge proportion of migration is between and within less developed countries, isn't it?
That's certainly true. And one of the issues that was raised by the UN's International Organization for Migration was that while the numbers of international migrants are still relatively small at 3.6% of the total, then the drivers of migration are changing, and those are geopolitics, technology, in the sense that people are looking on their smartphones or looking at routes and looking at news of people who have made it or particular ways to go, how to go about it, and climate change. And so all of these are intensifying, as the UN said, and that's being accompanied by a political move to try and cut off the safe avenues for migration. And so that together is exacerbating the issue in certain parts of the world.
Mm. The other issue also that is focused on, and this is where it's quite important at an intergovernmental level, is that remittances are so hugely important for some countries. Remittances from people who then, you know, travel abroad, try to migrate, settle somewhere else, and then send money home.
That's right. There's very much an economic issue. Again, the UN's case is that there's clear evidence that supports that is in support of international migration because it's helping economies such as Mexico, for example. The central bank issues monthly details on the level of remittances, which are in the billions of dollars. And so that the UN is saying there's not only that factor, but also the issue that the more people who are in an economy, then it's a larger labour pool, potentially enlarging the economy.
Well, if the numbers are rising relatively slowly, why does it feel like that's not the case? Why does it seem that so many people are of the impression that there is a massive increase in migration?
I think it's important to state that, you know, this article is by no means intending to diminish the issue. There are very clear increases in certain routes. You know, the mass migration out of Venezuela, for example, it's several millions of people over the past several years as a result of the oppressive regime and the economic situation, economic collapse, frankly. And so there's undoubtedly an issue at the southern US border. Equally, as I mentioned, the numbers crossing the Mediterranean and, frankly, dying in trying to do so is a huge source of political tension at EU levels. And as you know, in the UK, then this is a big political issue, and it's not to try and massage these figures away. There's undoubtedly an issue, but what came through clearly in the reporting is that governments are scrambling to try and find answers, and no one really has any viable solution as yet.
Alan, thank you so much for being with us. Bloomberg Senior Economy and Government Editor Alan Crawford there, taking us through, well, the sort of big picture, the data, top-down view, at least, of the global flow of migration. It's actually 281 million international migrants that the UN has pulled up as the figure for international migration. So growing, yes, it's 1990, but versus the 1990 figure, 153 million. So actually quite slow growth, but nonetheless, as Alan says, an enormously hot button political issue.
Yeah, not an insignificant number, particularly where they're not distributed evenly around the world. Well, let's bring in our next two guests on this. Let's speak to Jenny Jones, who is a Green Party member of the House of Lords, also former Deputy Mayor of London from 2003 to 2004. And Sally Hayden, a journalist and author of the book My Fourth Time We Drowned, about the world's deadliest migration route. Jenny, I want to start with you. Just tell us briefly what the objections in the Lords are to the government's Rwanda bill.
Essentially, it's a bill that's not only illegal, it's also absolutely inhumane, but worse, it's plain daft, because it's never going to happen. It doesn't matter when we actually let it through. It's a complete non-runner. It's cost billions so far, and every person that we send over there is going to cost another 2 million. What we could have done is put in safe routes, made sure there were enough courts to process all the claimants, and quite honestly, this government has pushed through this bill on us, and it's a crazy bill.
Yeah, £370 million is the official watchdog view on how much the Rwanda bill has cost so far through the courts and so on. In terms of the concerns, though, I mean, some critics have said that the bill has gone through the Commons, that holding it up in the Lords in this detailed way with 10 amendments to the Safety of Rwanda bill, that is sort of denying the will of the people. Certainly that's the criticism. How would you respond to that?
The second chamber, the House of Lords, is actually part of our democracy, and our job is to actually read the bills. MPs don't read bills. They don't have time. So we read all the legislation. We point out all the problems that there might be. And we try to be as helpful as possible to make the legislation as good as possible. Now, as soon as the Rwanda bill came to us the first time, some of us tried to stop it completely, because clearly what it is asking us to do is say that Rwanda is a safe country now and in the future. Now, well, first of all, most of us don't believe it's safe now. But secondly, how can we commit to the future? And within the bill, there's no way of checking, you know, if circumstances change, there's no way of checking whether or not it's still safe, if it even is safe. So it is our job. And I think we do it very well.
The Rwanda bill may be unpopular in Green Party areas, but it's a policy that has popular support across much of the country. How would the Green Party tackle the problem of illegal immigration?
I've been out canvassing in some of the most Tory areas in Britain, and I've lost count of the people who said to me, I voted Tory all my life, I can't vote for this lot again. So what the Greens would do is we would set up systems of safe routes. And I'm sure you know already that a majority of people who actually take their asylum claims to court are allowed to stay because they have genuine claims. They are distressed and desperate, and they come here because they want to make a life. They don't want to come here to sponge off the system. They want to actually, they want to be shopkeepers, they want to be doctors, they want to be carers, they want to be working in the fields, they want to be taxpayers. And so what the Green Party would do is set up safe routes and make sure that there are, that the courts are able to process all those people. And some will get returned because they're not genuine claimants, but a majority will be allowed to stay and they will support our economy. Every healthy society, every healthy economy needs people to come in. They need immigration. It's something that rejuvenates and fills gaps in our system. So for the Tories to set up these huge backlogs they have deliberately created is actually much, much worse for Britain than if they just allowed these people to go to court and have their claims assessed.
Yeah, Baroness Jones, I'm sure that, that the government would reject that claim that, that it has been purposefully set up, that it's an issue with court capacity and so much else besides. But let me bring in Sally Hayden at this
point. I'm not making a judgment here. I'm telling you the way it is. They on purpose have stopped any possibility of safe routes for the majority of people coming in. So this is not my green view. This is a fact. And you're arguing the government case, I think, is a bit specious.
Sally Hayden, let me bring you in at this point. Journalist and author, we mentioned your book at the start. I mean, you've been reporting extensively about the migration crisis. You've tracked the routes yourself. You won awards for your most recent book, detailing the kind of consequences of Europe's anti-immigration policies on individuals. And I know you've been to Rwanda a number of times. So, you know, when we look at this issue of migration just beyond the UK, I think it's very interesting to get your view. I mean, what are these migrant journeys like? In the UK, a lot of the argument has been around people smugglers, about them being the enablers, and if those groups are smashed, you know, that that would aid. Just tell me, Sally, what the migrant route journeys are really like from your first-hand experience.
First of all, there's something else I'd like to speak about, which I think is highly relevant to the current debate, and I've just gone public about. So my book that you mentioned, My Fourth Time We Drowned, does look at EU anti-migration policies in the Central Mediterranean, but it also has a specific chapter on the EU-backed scheme to send people, to evacuate people from Libya to Rwanda, and they were moved there temporarily before being moved on to Western countries. And I went there in 2019 and 2020 to report on Rwanda. I was told that I was only being given media accreditation because they believed that I would write good things about them. I was still denied access to certain camps, but I had a lot of contacts already in the camps, so I ended up doing reporting anyway. My reporting, which it does make up a chapter of the book, was submitted in the legal challenge against the UK Home Office, challenging this Rwanda deportation deal, because the UK Home Office have used the EU scheme as kind of, you know, they say that that maybe is evidence that things can work with Rwanda. So it has come up in arguments, and my reporting was to argue against that. And I then tried to travel to Rwanda 3 weeks ago to report again. I was denied boarding onto the plane. I was told that Rwandan authorities had contacted the airline and told them that I specifically am not allowed to board a plane now to Rwanda. And I think that this actually is highly significant in terms of what the speaker before me was saying about how can you track that Rwanda is safe and that it will be safe in the future if there's been a total shutdown on reporting. There's no media freedom. There's no freedom of speech. You're not allowing journalists into the country. And as a journalist who won the Orwell Prize, like the UK's top political writing prize for my work, including my work on Rwanda, the fact that I've been banned 3 weeks before, or apparently banned anyway, they haven't given me an official explanation, but 3 weeks before this bill seems likely to pass. I mean, I think that's shocking.
But the tide is against you. For example, I mentioned this week Wednesday, the European Parliament voted in favour of a major piece of legislation that they've been, you know, talking about discussing for 10 years, the Migrant and Asylum Pact, that fast tracks asylum procedures at the EU's border. I mean, the tide is against your perspective.
You're saying my perspective, but I'm a journalist. I'm not an activist. I'm not proposing specific policy. But what I am saying is that, like, the consequences of the policies, they need to be documented. And of course, like, media freedom is important. And when you shut down media freedom, the fact that, like, my reporting has shown that Western countries, you know, not just the UK, also the EU, are spending huge amounts of money to stop migration in ways that are propping up dictatorships, militias, warlords, and actually increasing the reasons that people are being oppressed and increasing the reasons that they need to flee. And so I am not advocating for a specific policy, but I do think when creating policies, you need to be aware of the actual implications of them. And I think that there's been such a kind of focus on political rhetoric that is so removed from what actually is happening. And I do encourage people, for example, to read my book. I'm not saying this to promote it. I'm saying it because, like, it gives people a greater understanding into the actual realities of this beyond, you know, the just these sound bites that are being shared.
Sally, I'm keen to get your view on people smugglers. We're told that smugglers by politicians and in the media are the real enablers of this trade. But do you see them at all differently in the work you've done across Africa?
Yeah, I mean, again, I've reported extensively on people smuggling routes. Smugglers are fulfilling a need. So this kind of saying, you know, we're breaking the business model of smugglers doesn't make sense unless you're giving people other ways to travel, because what smugglers are doing is fulfilling a need. There's no other ways for people to make these journeys, or there are often no other ways. And there's not a lot of faith in, you know, the so-called legal routes, like the resettlement schemes, for example. I've reported on allegations of corruption that are quite widespread in those. And yeah, at the same stage, I mean, I'm not saying smugglers are great people. Again, I've reported on the trials of people smugglers. A chapter in the book focuses on two very significant people smugglers, and I was the only international observer and their trial in Ethiopia. And one of them ended up escaping afterwards because there wasn't attention being put on these kind of high level people. And I think a lot, again, it's a lot of rhetoric rather than actual, you know, appreciation of the real situation. Like, that's why even having discussions like this, I tend to try and focus on my reporting, because I think, you know, it can be so far removed from the actual reality.
Well, I want to put a slightly brutal question to you on this. You have argued that this debate, you know, a number of times you've made this point, that actually Europe's migrant policies are sort of divorced from the consequences, and that if people knew and understood, they would have a different view. It's not as if the migrant issue is unknown. I mean, people do see the number of deaths in the Mediterranean. You know, that you say that European people don't understand the human experience. Maybe people do. They just want to limit migration. I mean, that might be a slightly depressing take on things. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been saying this over and over again, that what we have right now is a global inequality crisis. So what has been called a migration crisis is actually a global inequality crisis. Large portions of the world are living in very, very horrific conditions. I was in South Sudan a few weeks ago, where 1,000 people every day are crossing the border from Sudan trying to flee the war there. The Sudan war has been called the biggest displacement crisis in the world. You know, I've reported recently in Somalia, in various other situations where huge numbers of people are dying from various causes. And it's shocking, and it's very hard to look at, and it's very hard to be faced with these types of crises. But, like, actually the crisis is, you know, those wars and those situations, and spending lots and lots of money to try and make a problem go away doesn't address those actual situations that people are trying to escape from.
And Jenny, just a final quick one to you. Would it be fair to say that the Greens are the most pro-immigration party in the UK? And does it concern you being on the wrong side of majority opinion?
If you talk to farmers, they want workers for their fields. If you talk to the NHS, they need doctors, and these doctors are going to have to come from abroad. We're short of carers. We're short of an awful lot of people. And so I think What you're reflecting is stuff from the Daily Mail and the Daily Express and the hard right wing of the Tory party. But I don't think the majority of people think like that. On my travels around, people say, well, you know, immigration, we've got to have some, obviously. That's what the majority of people think. They understand that it can be a net good for our country. So I think probably Greens are the most pro-immigration because in a lot of ways we are the most realistic political party. It's us who talks about the devastation that's happening in other countries. And the fact, of course, that a lot more people are going to be displaced because of climate change. I mean, you only have to look at our fields at the moment. They are flooded. We are in trouble when you look at whether or not we're going to have enough food grown in the UK this summer. And that is replicated all over the world, not floods, but droughts and all sorts of other really severe weather happenings. And so, you know, I think we're the realists here and everybody else are the ostriches burying their heads in the sand.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining us today. It's been very good speaking to you. Jenny Jones, member of the House of Lords for the Green Party, Baroness Jones, thank you for your time. And also to the journalist Sally Hayden, author of the book My Fourth Time We Drowned, about the migration crisis. As you say, Ewan, it is a hugely important voter issue, not just in the UK, but across Europe, in North America, globally, in a year of very significant polls in the UK and the US and elsewhere. So very pleased to be able to speak to both of you on that topic today, with MPs in the UK voting on the Rwanda bill.
Yeah, well, that's it for us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo. Our audio engineer was Sean Guastamacchia. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Ewan Potts. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.